An unsilent woman speaks up for herself and for change. She uses her voice and owns her story to create culture and community, fearlessly and unapologetically. Hi, I'm Purva Miller. Join me as I talk to trailblazers and changemakers about questioning the status quo, building success, and creating a life that truly inspires. So grab a cozy beverage of your choice and get comfy. This is the Women in Our Town podcast.
Hey there. Welcome to episode 4 of the Women in Our Town podcast. This episode is going to be a real treat because I'm talking to the fabulous Elizabeth Sue, founder of Monday Vibes, your go-to place for regular doses of self-care and a feel-good start to the week. Described as a bubbly, confident, wise, kind older sister, Monday Vibes is an all-in-one weekly personal growth newsletter that brings a cozy slumber party feel to some of life's hardest challenges. I met Elizabeth virtually, and we had one of the best conversations I've had all year. A self-love evangelist, Elizabeth is on a mission to change the narrative that women have been told about self-love and happiness. She graduated summa cum laude from Tufts University with a BS in quantitative economics and community health, reaching a six-figure salary at a hot Silicon Valley startup, where she could drink all the hashtag kombucha on tap before realizing she was trying to win a game she didn't even want to play. After struggling with an eating disorder and severe anxiety, Elizabeth said goodbye to a decade-long career in corporate to pursue a master's degree at Columbia University in clinical psychology with a concentration in spirituality and mind-body practices, and an advanced certification in sexuality, women, and gender. While at Columbia, her work around burnout and perfectionism in corporate women and the science of happiness was given the honor of distinction in research and creative work. Elizabeth has since dedicated herself to empowering women, teaching about emotional and spiritual wellness, and changing the rules of the game. Welcome, Elizabeth. I am thrilled to be talking to you this afternoon.
Oh my gosh, me too. I've been looking forward to this. Thank you so much for having me on your beautiful show.
You know, it's so interesting because we spoke a few weeks ago and I left that conversation just feeling so refreshed, so energized, feeling like I was talking to somebody that was putting into words exactly what I've been thinking for so long. And you know, so we touched on so many interesting things, your work on perfectionism. I think you really delve into the core and the crux of what it is to be a woman and how much we struggle with it. And so it was funny. I actually read a blog that you wrote titled, "Are You White Knuckling Through Life?" And that really resonated with me because as a writer, you know, writing 750 words or 1500 words, that can sometimes take me days and days because I am overthinking everything I'm writing. I'm trying to back up everything with research because not so much because I don't even have conviction in what I'm saying, but because I feel like I need to, you know, be backed by data and be so credentialed.
Yes.
You know, for anyone to listen to what I have to say. So, you know, I really like to kind of, you know, get to the core of what it is that's, you know, driving this sense of perfectionism in us. You know, I thought I left the corporate world and I thought that that would go away now that I'm working for myself. And I find that it hasn't, but I felt it so strongly when I was working in the corporate world as well. So I'd love to, you know, get your thoughts on kind of what's at the root of this feeling.
Oh, thank you for that question. It's what keeps me going every day. As I reflect on my own inner journey and help others through their, through overcoming perfectionism, because my core thesis is, the research shows that in the last 30 years, perfectionism has increased 33%, which is astounding. It's astounding and not surprising at the same time. But what really struck me was, so perfectionism is broken up into three distinct categories. The first is self-inflicted perfectionism, which is you know, what we more commonly think about perfectionism, you know, being hard on ourselves, setting high expectations for ourselves. The second is other-oriented perfectionism, which is, you know, you can think of the micromanager. When you have high expectations for yourself, you have high expectations for other people. If you don't have compassion for yourself, it's hard to have compassion for other people. Then the third is socially prescribed perfectionism. And this is, to me, this is like the missing piece of the conversation, which is, what are our academic systems doing to us? What are our family systems doing to us? What is the workplace doing to us? And you look, what is media and Hollywood doing to us? Mm-hmm. And over time, so the research shows that specifically is of the different elements of perfectionism, that's the one that is driving this increase and this relentless striving for a never-ending goal. And when I came across that, my heart just fell on the ground because I was like, this is what I have been trying to tell people. Like, it's not me. You know, it's me. It has gotten to the point where it's me, but that's where I am so emboldened to share that I believe perfectionism is a form of internalized oppression. It's the oppressor, women of color, doing the work. It's the oppressed, doing the work for the oppressor. Like, right. We have internalized all these pressures and expectations put on us, not to mention all the ways that we have observed with our own eyes and our own heart how we are treated less than. And we pretzel ourselves into this version that is more accepted, more palatable, more expected in society. And that's what fuel. So it's almost like we pick up these little clues and then we self-police, we self-censor, we control ourselves, which is the agenda of the patriarchy. So it's kind of like they wash their hands clean.
Yeah.
And then it is our, our quote unquote, our problem. But yeah, so that's kind of what I really think about is what are these societal forces that are driving us towards this, you know, towards having such a harsh inner critic and this never ending sense of hustle.
Yeah, it's so true, because all of the messages that are coming, you know, that we're fed through social media, all of the message that we're fed, you know, through our families, through Hollywood, everything you hear is that if for some reason you are struggling, you're not cutting it, you're not hustling hard enough. And, you know, I've actually done a lot of reflection myself on my own experience as an example in the corporate world. And I found that it was, you know, I would sometimes sit and think that, like, I work really hard. I do all this extra work that, you know, so many of my colleagues don't even do, like, you know, these committees, these diversity committees, these, you know, competitions, like corporate social responsibility. And then at the end of the year, I'm getting critiqued in like feedback reviews on these things that don't even matter. And meanwhile, other people that have done, like, maybe not done the same types of projects are, you know, getting the right clients, yes, getting the right projects and are moving forward and are moving ahead. And this was something that was always so, like, it was this contention in me, because I was like, I thought that part of perfectionism, part of doing well, part of hard work was, like, you know, taking on a lot, taking on more, instead of just showing up. And then I would see people that just show up and they just sail through. And it was mind-boggling to me until, I have to say, this year, when so much of the conversation has shifted towards understanding racial oppression in the workplace, yes, in this non-obvious way. And I feel like maybe I'm starting to find language that I can, that you know, allows me to articulate what this was. Up until now, I thought it was something wrong with me. I thought that I wasn't, you know, cutting it, or yes. I couldn't understand, you know, what it was about my situation that was hard. And so, yeah, it's, I guess it is this external, you know, I don't know. I know you've had your own experience in the corporate world and left for, you know, the work of an artist now that I would yeah. say. So, you know, maybe you can speak to this, or this resonates with you.
Oh my gosh. Well, for that's just the nicest compliment I could ask for. I feel like I'm just, you know, I'm, it's very layered. I'm half Chinese. I did really well academically. I pursued this very cutthroat and excelled in these cutthroat corporate worlds. And as you know, I've had this, this awakening that I'm an artist and I do not belong in a linear world, or, you know, a world that doesn't appreciate feelings or intuition. That's, so thank you for that. And I know you and I have talked about it before, and it really left a lasting impact, this idea. And I've done more reading and more reflection and more conversation with my other friends of color, and just thinking about the immigrant experience and how our ancestors, our families' survival tactics, what they needed to do to survive in this country, to get by, is, for lack of a better word, exploited in the workplace.
Yeah.
And I just really, having studied burnout mm-hmm. and studied perfectionism, you know, I have to say, you know, you look at the samples of the data being collected, and it's white, Midwest, college psychology classes for the most part. That's the demographic that they're taking data on. So that to begin with is part of the problem. Okay. Right. So we're looking at these very important mental health, I would like to underscore, mental health issues. We're talking about well-being. Mm-hmm. I think we really do not view burnout and perfectionism we don't give them the weight that they need in terms of the negative impact it has on people. In fact, in the workplace, the research shows that perfectionism is, I mean, doesn't even need research, but, you know, as we were talking about at the top of the call, I similarly, you know, am on this journey of not needing to prove myself, but I find in a lot of spaces, I have to have the research to share what I intuitively know and what everyone else right. can observe around them. But, you know, it's not a surprise that the research shows one of the norms of modern day workplaces, which prioritize toxic masculinity, is show no weakness, with mm-hmm. aka perfectionism. Mm-hmm. That is what is rewarded and celebrated mm-hmm. in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And so and then I remember back in the day, you know, when you were practicing, like, what is your weakness and yours? Like a half weakness, because as we were saying, yeah. workplaces don't like weaknesses. Yeah. So you're like, I'm a bit of a perfectionist. I tend to go a little overboard, or I tend to be a bit of an overachiever.
Oh, I got it. I hope people are not asking those questions anymore in interviews. I can't believe we actually ever ask those questions and expected to get an honest answer.
Right? It's just, now that I'm out and I can breathe again, I reflect and laugh on it, but yeah. I do think about how all this to say, you know, race is not, we're not even like, we've barely even addressed gender. We're mm-hmm. not even talking about race in this equation and how, yeah. and how, you know, workplaces then, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So if it's not important to leadership or to the culture to be conscious and aware of, you know, this, of the stereotypes, you know, that Asians, for example, have, then you might not realize what you could, what problems you continue to perpetuate.
Yeah. And that's a fair point. And it's, it kind of like reminds me of this article that I read by this woman named Hadia Rodrigue, it called Black on Bay Street, because, you know, I'm in Canada, you know, in Canada, I think we think that, oh, we're such a multicultural country. And it is a multicultural country. But again, I'm in Toronto, it's a different vibe here than it is in many parts of the country. But even in Toronto, I read this article by this woman, Hadia Rodrigue, and she talks about her experience of getting to Bay Street, which is our Wall Street, and what that was, you know, what it was like all the way up to get to Bay Street. But then more importantly, once she had entered the law firms, the really prestigious firms you know, Seven Sister Firms of Canada, what that experience was like. And in her article, this diversity consultant, Ritu Basin, who actually does speak at a lot of corporate diversity events, actually says that she's the author of The Authenticity Principle. And she says, people feel they have to change who they are, move away from their authentic self to get ahead. But there's only so much conforming, masking we can do. It eats away at your spirit. And after a while, you'll either be pushed out or self-select out because it's exhausting to be someone you're not. And so I'm a big fan of Ritu Basin, by the way. Her work's actually very interesting. She writes about and talks a lot about authenticity and gives trainings in the corporate space about a lot of that stuff. But I'd you know, love to, you know, get your take on what that actually does to mental health, what this sort of internalized oppression and internalized self-censoring does to mental health. Because I've probably done it in my career without even realizing that I'm doing it, which again, once you sit back and you reflect, you realize how much of it you were actually doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd just be curious to see how many people might relate to this, might actually be relating to this right now, as you know, in 2020, when we think, oh, we're starting to scratch the surface with tackling racism and.
I think it's very present right now. I know from my own experience, you know, I started therapy about 7-8 years ago. And, you know, at the time it was, I have compassion for every part of my journey, but I look back and I'm like, whoa, you know, anxiety, that was like, you know, so surface, it seems, to like where I'm at now, where it just feels like I'm like in the trenches of like racial trauma.
Yeah.
And I'm like eating this, you know, but like, of course, all of the stages and chapters of your journey are important. But I do think there's something about, I had molded myself so much. I had become a complete chameleon. I did not even know who I was. I mean, I thought I was an extrovert. I'm not. Yeah. I thought I was, you know, a math person. Like I love writing. You know, I was so far removed. I was so far removed from my body. I mean, that's what anorexia is. Like, you are completely dissociated from your body. Yeah. And so that was really like, you know, and I got my yoga teacher training. I really like took those first steps to just like get back in my body. We're not talking about, you know, I could not even begin to unpack, you know, intergenerational trauma at that time. I was just trying to like get up and like eat and like love myself at the most basic core. And so I think, you know, now what I'm really observing is with more dialogue around race, systemic racism, which is important. We're not talking about like just like, you know, random, you know, acts of racism or microaggression. Yes, that obviously is important, but this is, I think finally we're, like you said, you know, getting the language, getting the awareness, getting the footage that this is so much larger than any individual, and that we have to come together as a collective to address this. And I think no matter what, you know, your racial identity is, I think it's come into question or come into conversation at some point this year in particular. Mm-hmm. And it's sad. Like, I've had to do a lot of grieving this year, and I have really been reflecting on my research in burnout and perfectionism about the role that race plays in that. Why am I, you know, as an Asian American woman, you know, so fucking exhausted? You know, where's the intersectionality of that? Like, sure, you can't objectively point to any one thing, but what I'm starting to do is really reclaim all these parts of myself that I had tossed to the sidewalk because I had to. Yeah. That was how I got ahead. I thought I was white for 30 years of my life. And it's like, it was very, it's like, I'm in the reclamation period, but right. At first it was very disillusioning. And I was just like, oh my God, like talk about, you know, we talk about having to give up like the clothes that you wear in the office. You know, we talk about I joke, my first week out of corporate, I painted my nails black. Mm-hmm. I was like, fuck this, I'm going black. You know, so like those so are little daring. Ways.
The worst right? thing you can do.
Such a rebel.
Such a rebel.
I wear like feather earrings and like black nail polish and cowboy boots. And we think about these little ways that we conform ourselves. And then we think about these big ways and rejecting your race. I'm like, that is, you know, and the number one way to combat perfectionism is unconditional self-love and self-acceptance. And so I really think about it and I'm like, how is it possible for me to love myself if I don't even see myself as me? Yeah. If the world does not even see me as me.
Yeah.
So now I'm like looking back at all of this and I'm like, it is inextricably linked, mm-hmm. inextricably linked. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And, you know, as a lay person who doesn't have that body of research to kind of be able to sift through to understand these feelings, I can totally commiserate with you because I was in the corporate world for the last 8 years. And it was sort of this a very similar sort of experience where like little things that I wouldn't think were a problem, you know, I would just see the difference in the effort, in the levels of effort, not to say that these people didn't put in effort, but just the levels of effort other, you know, people of color feel they need to be putting in to be considered at the same levels. I don't even know where we begin. I don't know if this is something that's of tremendous importance in, you know, like you said, it's just a matter of what company values and what matters to the CEOs. I've read data points that say that businesses do better, you know, mm-hmm. if they're diverse, and if for no other reason than it makes good business sense to have diversity on your teams. But what is that diversity? Is that just box checking, or is that actual real diversity?
Exactly. And I think about that a lot because, you know, the companies that I worked for, they were consistently, you know, top on the list of Glassdoor's best places to work. Yeah. You know, the optics looked really good. Yeah. And I drank the Kool-Aid for sure.
Yeah. I did too. You, this you is have all like to. Stuff that I'm thinking about now in hindsight. Back then I was like, this is all so great. Like, what's there to complain? I've got a great job and I'm doing well. I'm moving forward in my career. And, you know, I'm happy. I'm learning. I'm telling myself all these things.
I must be exhausted because I'm so needed. Yeah. I must be asked to do all this like unpaid labor because I'm important. I think that's really, you know, it's really loaded. And I think you touched on what is at the heart of it. It's about the heart, you know, and it's about your intentions, and it's about change. You know, just like when we talk about the system, I mean, we're talking about the big system, the little systems, the patriarchal systems within us, the white supremacist systems within us. So it's like, you know, all these, what do you call them, like concentric circles. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of dismantling that needs to be done. And so you can't just like check the boxes and bring diversity into your workplace without actually examining like how are you supporting them, how are you changing your own unconscious bias, are you doing the motto of my graduate program was inner work for outer change. Right. And I really believe that it really starts with you. So everyone has to be committed to their own dismantling of racism within themselves and their own healing and their own reclamation of the totality of themselves as a human, not a worker. Mm-hmm. And I think that becomes, we try to really place logic and structure on these things, but it's actually so simple. You know, if you become an anti-racist within yourself, that trickles outwards. Yeah. That you don't have to try so hard if you have really done the work. And I think we're really running into these problems with optics where it seems like you're like in solidarity or in support, but then when you look at, you know, just little microaggressions or little ways that like women of color have to work harder, or women have to work harder, or introverts have to work harder. I mean, we're talking, it's so layered. And I think we're at a juncture where we're really being asked to look at what is valued, who is in power, mm-hmm. who is in power, mm-hmm. Who is, you know, as much as people need to lean in, who is leaning out, who is invited to that table. It's not just about taking up space. It's about, is there space to take up?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I actually wrote a piece about this on my blog a few weeks ago about what I learned about corporate feminism. And one of the things I realized, you know, I was such a disciple of the lean-in movement when it came out. And such a
Cheryl. I started a lean-in group.
There you go.
Lean-in women's group.
diversity committee and women's committees, right? But it was, I looked up to Sheryl Sandberg. She was, you know, this powerful woman in Silicon Valley. And I thought that this was, what she was saying was so right. But in hindsight, I feel like Lean In Feminism is that palatable brand of corporate feminism where if you are already in those spaces and if you are invited at the table, then you can lean in. And even there, I find that a bit problematic because to lean in, you know, I felt like the central crux of Sheryl Sandberg's thesis and of her book was that, you know, women have to essentially, and she didn't say it in those words, I can't remember what words she said it in, but the message that I took away from that was that women had to ultimately conform to the corporate, you know, what, like the corporate ecosystem that was created by men for men.
For men.
Right? Yes. As opposed to trying to change that ecosystem to be an inclusive space where many more, you know, voices could be invited to the table to before they could even start to lean into it, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I also had this like this epiphany that was like so devastating. It shattered everything that like I thought, you know, that's why I said in my bio, you know, it shattered everything I thought about playing this game because I was good at playing the game and then I burned out. Mm-hmm. Like that's what burnout is. Burnout isn't like too much work or like not efficient enough. It's when you have to lean so far in that you fall over with exhaustion.
Right.
And I just see that with all of my female peers. And, you know, I think there is a level of numbing out. I mean, my drinking was like pretty unhealthy when I was in corporate.
Mine as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
and maybe you see the same symptoms over, you know, like was like work till like, I remember I was working at a law firm and I would come home at like 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock I would actually work till 8 o'clock and then come home. I'd have dinner at the firm, come home and then pour myself a glass of wine and sit on my couch and flick through my phone shopping online. Because it's just like, you know, I needed to, I guess, feel a lot.
So, yeah,
this is it's what like I was that, doing.
Right? Or just numb out.
I
loved just the numb feeling. Like the less I had to pay attention to how uncomfortable I was and how tired I was and how not myself I was, the better. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot about that time and how, you know, I use all sorts of coping mechanisms that just added on top of each other this general I was so unwell. And I think that goes back to at the core just not being able to be who you are. And I got tired. And I do think, you know, you asked about mental health. I mean, perfectionism manifests in so many ways. Burnout manifests in so many ways. You have, it can be anxiety. It can be depression. It can be suicidal ideation. It can be substance abuse. It can be eating disorders. It's like so well researched. These mental, physical, and emotional impacts. And yet we still fight for capitalism and we still prioritize profit over people. Yeah. And it's really, it's sad and it's upsetting. And I think what's interesting is I experienced imposter syndrome, and I think many of us have. And again, it's one of those things where you're supposed to just go to a workshop and feel more confident.
Yeah.
And yet the research shows, you know, if you're part of a marginalized group, of course you're going to struggle with imposter syndrome because you walk into the room and people already have assumptions that you are less than, that your voice does not matter as much. And so I think instead of like pretending that, first of all, instead of putting the onus on the marginalized person to like be better at being a white man, we need to like
be absurd when you say it too, like be better at being a white man. Okay, well, I'll get right on it.
Right, exactly. That's how it feels. It's like, oh well, let me, you know, I just like have so much compassion for my younger self who was in all these workshops and like, you know, was like so committed to succeeding. I look back, I'm like, well, no shit, like I like couldn't quote unquote hack it. Like it was never gonna happen for me, for someone that looks like me. And not to be like fatalist about it, like of course there are like women in positions of leadership, although not many women of color in positions of leadership, and that's an important part of this shift that I think we're both like wanting to see. But I do think there needs to be just a across the board reality check on what it is we're really asking of people.
I agree. And so in, you know, you do so much work on self-care, and you know, I love your newsletter. I love getting it in my inbox every Monday. It's such a treat. I love your dance parties on Instagram. If you're not following Elizabeth, go do that now, because she has these awesome dance parties. Often it's music from the 90s, so beloved favorites, Backstreet Boys. Yes, and that's right. It's just so, it's amazing. I love it. I told my husband, I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. We should do this. So, definitely follow Elizabeth and join in on the dance party.
Yes, please. The more the merrier. It makes me feel less crazy.
No, we're dancing with you. But you know, I'd love to know a little bit more about like how you found courage, how you came to the realization that this wasn't working for you and this wasn't serving you, and how you found the courage to leave. Like once someone gets into Silicon Valley, it's so hard to kind of see the light and be like, well, this is no longer working for me. How'd you find the courage to leave?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I really appreciate the word courage that you used, because it's so much nicer than what I often tell myself, because when I look back at that time, it was almost like I was so miserable it was a necessity. So I am going to think about it more as courage from now on. But it was two things. One, it was I was miserable and exhausted and sick, physically sick all the time. I got the flu like every other week. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but not too much. Right. And so I was physically unwell, mentally, spiritually unwell. And then at the same time, you know, as I mentioned before, I got my yoga teacher training, and I was like, ooh, like what's this world? Oh my gosh, crystals and sage and spirit guides. And it was just so fun and playful. Yeah. And I started making new friends that weren't in the Silicon Valley sphere, that really showed me, oh, there's another way to live life. There's another way to find happiness. Mm-hmm. And then I just devoured like a million self-help personal growth books, just on this search of just trying to understand myself, trying to understand like where things went wrong, mm-hmm. Trying to understand what to do next. The what to do next was definitely the most stressful. As it is with anything, no one likes uncertainty. That's why it's hard to change.
Right.
But I I somehow mustered up the courage to start my own business while I was in corporate, which was a wedding. I call myself the Woola, the wedding doula. It was a mindful wedding business. And it was right after my wedding, because when I was at my wedding, you have those pivotal life moments, and I don't mean to be cheesy, but it was one of the happiest days of my life. Like I felt so loved. Andrew and I had been together over 8 years. We'd lived many lifetimes together. It was a big deal. Mm-hmm. And I remember like at the edge of the aisle walking down, you know, I'm a crier. So I was just like bawling. And people are always like, hold it together. Or like, don't cry. I'm like, why? Like crying shows that I care and I care about this day.
Yeah.
And I remember just like time stood still. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this is the good stuff. Like mm-hmm. this is.
Yeah.
This is what it means to be alive. And in contrast to how I was also very sick on my wedding because of trying to cram everything in before my wedding date. And so just having that in contrast and then coming back to my job where I felt like life had been zapped out of me again, I was like, gosh, there has to be a bridge. There has to be a third option. Yeah. And so when I started that, I joined a business course that was like Hogwarts for entrepreneurs, where it was
like so much fun.
It was mixed spirituality and business. And I met, you know, like 100 different female spiritual entrepreneurs that use like crystal in their business and tarot in their business. And I was like, this is it. Like, and so I watched myself be able to work twice as many hours as I had before, just like, you know, hustling mm-hmm. with this side project. Yet I was so much more energized. And I was like, okay, like this is what purpose is. This is what they talk about when it's like your dharma or when you're in alignment. So I just decided to follow. I was like, I don't know where it will take me. And obviously it's taken me in many different directions, but I try to tune into my body. I'm like, I want more of that feeling and less of this other mm-hmm. feeling.
That's amazing. I mean, like that sounds Hogwarts for business and spirituality. Sounds like it would be the best school ever.
Yes.
And I mean, I have to admit, I've been relatively up until now, I wasn't raised very spiritually or religiously. We always thought of yoga as like a more of a physical activity. And I think that is also how it is a lot of the times here in the West, as opposed to there's just all of the spirituality behind yoga. I mean, it's such an ancient tradition, technically from my culture. Oh, and a very interesting actually point. I was talking to Ryan about this, just, you know, really quickly on this yoga point a couple of days ago, where I said, it's so frustrating to go on Instagram and look at yoga, you know, a lot of people doing yoga, because it seems that everybody doing yoga is white. And it's like,
they're in these like crazy positions.
They're in these crazy
and like semi-anorexic.
And it's like, yes, I want, you know, yoga is a space for everybody and it is very inclusive. But why is it that the images that we see of yoga are predominantly only white people doing yoga, ideally on a beach, when it's actually a very ancient Indian practice? Why don't we see any of that, you know, that history, that spirituality, those ancient teachings? Why don't we see any of that stuff out there so that people can start to really understand where, you know, where yoga comes from and what its purpose is. But coming back to what you said about the crystals and the tarot, I've actually never been very spiritual. So I think before I used to be like, oh, well, that's just kind of in a woo-woo kind of mm-hmm. way. But
yeah,
now,
me too.
But now I'm starting to think that, you know what, maybe that's my own cynicism that's been bred in me by this societal idea of why should success only be good business only be being a hard ass and being really tough and being angry. Business can mean being gentle and spiritual and you know,
fun
and. So I think it might be starting to come closer I don't tell my husband, he's going to be like, I don't want to start seeing Amazon packages with healing crystals coming to our doorstep every other day. But you know,
you can really go off the deep end there.
But I do think that there is a space for business and spirituality to, yes. You know, this intersection of the two and I think that you're such a good voice for that, and you're such a good champion of that. And I love your Instagram. I think it's such a happy place, and your website is such a happy place. So, you know, I think there's a better way and a different way that we can be doing.
Oh my gosh! I thank you for that. It's funny, even with my website, I went through several iterations, and like in the beginning, it was still like so corporate, and you can watch this progression as I'm just like shedding that part of myself, which for me is that fun, playful, joyful, like that's me at my core. And that's who I always was as a kid. You know, that's what they call inner child work. I think all of us have that playful side, and that definitely was the side. And for me, that's very linked to my creativity, and that my creativity and my playful self, my playful, joyful self, those are the two things that really died in corporate. And when I think about it too long, it makes me emotional because it's so sad to see, to know that I went for so long in the academic system, you know, to see how long I had gone without that core part of me. And I, even now, you know, you mentioned my dance parties, and I remembered I started them a few weeks ago because people were so stressed, especially with the election. And it was a very, very heavy time. I mean, this whole year has been so heavy. Yeah. And I personally have been doing a lot of, you know, racial trauma healing, which is like tough stuff. Yeah. And I really was, and especially having an academic background, which actually I think can really get in the way of healing, because you tend to intellectualize things, you tend to like need proof for your experiences. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, people have been giving me feedback around, or I was even seeing it just out and about, you know, like 5 ways to cope with anxiety, or like, you know, research says blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no one needs like more stuff to like fill their brain. Like we're all at our max.
Yeah.
Like part of healing, I really believe part of healing is finding joy and taking, and that joy is part of taking care of yourself, and joy is activism work. And so I was like, you know what? I'm not going to host like some intellectual something, or like put something out that's just going to be another thing that people are trying to like learn. I'm going to just like put on the Backstreet Boys. And that's my healing for the day.
No, but it was so amazing, because it was so, you know, I felt like watching you, I felt like I was a kid again, and I was watching another, you know, kid just be silly and be themselves, because, you know, as a kid, you don't worry about anything. You don't care who's looking. No. You don't care who's watching. Well, very young kids, actually. Now I think it starts earlier and earlier that you start to care so much about these things. But, you know, I really loved that. And a couple of weeks ago, I was at one of my girlfriend's houses, and I was talking about something I'd seen on Instagram. And she said, I can't even be on Instagram these days, because not even that it's that there's anything bad. It's just that there's so much material that people yes. are trying to tell you or sell you about either yes. doing the work or examining racism or examining microaggressions, right. examining white fragility, examining oppression. And she's like, it's not that I don't want to do these things. I do. It's just at a certain point, I have to care about myself and I have to think about myself. And I remember in that moment, I briefly felt a little when she said, you know, I don't want to hear any more of it, thinking, well, you know, but how else are you going to learn and be able to do the work if you don't want to listen? And then I caught myself and I realized that what I was expecting of her in that moment wasn't fair, because it doesn't matter that, you know, there is this entire settler history that we've all been born right. into. And it doesn't matter that there is, not that it doesn't matter, it's always there. We've been born into a world where racism is so prevalent, where oppression is so prevalent, where inequality is so prevalent. We can't think and internalize it all the time. And if right. if you need to tap out and just take a moment for yourself and say, you know what, I know I have work to do, but today or right now, I just need to not read another blog about the work that I need to do.
Right.
That's fine. It's totally yes. fine. And that's not you being a white person, a bad person. That's not you being a white supremacist. That's not you, you know, not acknowledging your privilege. That's just simply you needing to take that moment for yourself.
Absolutely. I've thought a lot about that too. And I really have had to do a lot of my own inner work around this. And my therapist has been really helpful in like introducing this concept of spiritual activism, which is not spiritual bypassing, but it really mm-hmm. is this recognition of both. Like, there, again, we don't live in a binary world. We don't live in a vacuum. Like, everything is interconnected, and so is our being. And that when we burn out doing activism work, that continues, we continue to be oppressed. That's part of the oppressed yeah. experience. Yeah. And so self-care and self-love and joy and pleasure and fun are all acts of rebellion. That is yeah. activism in and of itself. So it's holding space for both, like not being complicit or not being apathetic, but also knowing mm-hmm. that you being your fully expressed, most joyful, integrated self mm-hmm. is the act of activism.
That's, you know, I think that that's a really interesting and important message. I remember you actually said this to me the first time we talked, and I hadn't thought about it that way. And then I did more reading about it, and it's true that we can't, you know, I find that so much of the work, as a person of color, we do so much of the work of learning ourselves. We're trying to learn to come to terms with intergenerational trauma. We're trying mm-hmm. to learn to come to terms with understanding our place in this world right. where, you know, we're maybe not, we feel like we don't belong, and we haven't been made to feel like we belong for so long.
Right.
And oftentimes we're also doing the work for other people, because we're doing the work of education. That's a very hard thing to do, especially because there's so much emotionality tied up with that when you're trying to explain to somebody else your perspective or how you feel or why, you know, something very, something that seemingly seems very simple or minor to them hurt you or affects mm-hmm. you. And so I think we take on that mantle so much. And that's not to say that others don't. I'm not by any stretch saying that, you know, white, this is only people of color or Black people or, you know, or Indigenous people. White people do this too. We're all trying to do this work right now. But I think that well, at a certain point, maybe we do need to tap out and say, you know what, this is not, that right now this isn't my problem. And right now I'm my problem and I'm my biggest priority and I need to take care of myself. And that in of itself is an act of oppression, because maybe it's time for someone else to do the work and figure it out for themselves.
Exactly. And I've really been thinking about that specifically because I find that is so connected to what we are talking about with explaining yourself and defending yourself mm-hmm. and your experience and needing that validation. And I was talking to a friend and we were like, we're gonna like not do that for right now. Like and I think about it in terms of my writing, you know, when I write about my experience as a biracial Asian American woman, like I want it to be authentic to my experience. I'm not here to censor someone's ego that might be triggered by it. Like this isn't meant to be a history lesson. This is my personal story. And so yeah. if you are unfamiliar with these terms, or you are unfamiliar with, or you don't think that you don't understand my experience, like that's not on me. And that's not on any person of color. That's not on any artist or writer. And I think it's that, to me, I've been learning that is one of the quickest things to dilute my writing and actually impact my mental health, because it makes me, it's almost a form of self-gaslighting. It makes yeah. me feel like talk about not being enough, you know, like that's it. Like that's the story. And, yeah. and it's not a two-way, it's not a two-way conversation. If it's evoking something for you, which I hope it does, that's the point mm-hmm. of writing. Mm-hmm. That's on you to explore for yourself. And I think that's really where we're seeing some reckoning in our society that is quite uncomfortable for people who haven't had to look inward as much as others. And and just thinking about our individual role in the movement and in the revolution is something that's been very present for me. Like we're not going to be very effective if we have our hands in all these pots and we're feeling very scattered and we're burnt out. Like we're put on this planet for a reason. So kind of to what we were talking about earlier about taking care of yourself and going inward, what is your responsibility is getting as clear as possible on what you're here to do, what you're yeah. here, what is the unique, what are your unique gifts? What are you uniquely placed on this planet to do, to heal? And I think that will really help the movement and help people who feel very like helpless or burnt out or yeah. guilty.
Yeah. You know, I think that's a really great message. And I think it's a great message to end this chat on, because I think what, you know, we've had a few conversations now, and for me, I feel like these conversations have been very healing, and they've actually made me feel more empowered to be more authentic in my writing, to be more authentic about my experience. I wrote the article about corporate feminism after we'd actually had our first conversation, because because it was something that, you know, up until then, like you said, your business goes through so many iterations, and I still haven't maybe yet pulled myself fully out of that corporate me that was me for so long. And you know, I still think sometimes when I'm writing something, well, what is someone on the internet going to think? Or what is someone, you know, on my LinkedIn feed who I know from, you know, 2 years ago, who I don't even speak to anymore. They're in a different place in their life. I'm in a different place in my life. But what if they see it? And what are they going to think? And I'm starting to do that inner work where, for me, I feel like my purpose is to be writing and talking and having these conversations and empowering women and telling these stories. And I can't do that in the best way. No, but I'm serious. I can't do that in the way that work deserves to be done if I'm feeling censored. And so, you know, I think the work that you're doing is really important. And you know, I'm going to be following it closely because it's really made a difference in my life. And,
thank you. So
thank you so much. And thank you for chatting with me today. I think this is awesome.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for having me. These conversations are always so life-giving, and what a gift to be in conversation with other amazing, talented, smart women. I really appreciate the work that you're doing to amplify women's voices and tell their stories, because I think that's really at the heart of our entire conversation, is that fight to be seen. Mm-hmm. And so to have more spaces where we're able to do that and able to support each other along the way is really important and really beautiful. So thank you for your work.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Elizabeth. It's been such a pleasure.
That's our show for this week, guys. Elizabeth's insights hit home, especially for me right now, because I'm in a space of transformation, as I'm sure a lot of you are coming out of 2020. And her thoughts on understanding burnout and perfectionism and loving yourself are all interconnected with issues around identity and, for BIPOC women, around racial trauma. So I'm going to sit with this and just be making space in 2021 to understand myself more, understand my inherited complexes, and not waste time or energy trying to explain myself to those who don't want to understand. I hope this talk with Elizabeth was valuable for you as well. My next guest is Kari Nixon. Kari is a medical humanist and professor specializing in social reactions to infectious disease. Her book, Quarantine Life, From Cholera to COVID-19, will be coming out from Simon & Schuster later this year. And we're going to be talking about understanding and, more importantly, processing the human and emotional response to the coronavirus, and if there are some lessons in there for all of us. Thanks for listening. And if you want more content from Women in Our Town, you can visit us at womeninourtown.com or follow the conversation at Women in Our Town on Instagram and Twitter. I'll speak to you soon.